Let's get to our first guest. And again, your calls 203-333-9422. And joining us live is Dr. Howard Foreman with the Yale School of Medicine, a professor of radiology and public health, and many more credentials, which, doctor, I think I mentioned more of them last time, but I'll suffice to say that you are with the Yale School of Medicine. So great to have you back on Newsline.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's get to it then. Whooping cough, right, has been making headlines. Now, I haven't really read about any specific cases in Connecticut. Maybe you can fill us in on that. But first of all, what is it? I feel like it's something that we really hadn't heard of for a good long time.
Yeah, so we've had a vaccine for decades right now, and it's highly, highly effective. And so we've gone from thousands of people dying and millions of people being infected to really 10 to 50,000 cases a year in the United States. And, you know, basically 10 or 15 people dying a year, which is still way too many because it is completely vaccine preventable. Whooping cough is called pertussis after the bacteria that causes it. And its characteristic is a hacking cough, multiple hacking coughs followed by a deep whooping sound as someone gasps for air. And it's also called the 100-day cough because it goes on for weeks and weeks, really months and months. And it is mostly of great concern in our infants, where about a third of all children under the age of one who get whooping cough will be hospitalized, and 1 in 100 to 1 in 200 will die from the infection.
That cough that you described, is that tough to identify, or is it very distinctive? I'm thinking back to when my kids were little. I feel like one of them had croup, and that was a bad sounding cough too. But this is something else, right?
Yeah, so I think being able to diagnose it by description is not necessary because we can swab children and test for it. So there are ways to diagnose it that go beyond just the characteristic cough, but it is still something a little more difficult to diagnose, mostly because we don't see that many cases. And even though the cases in the state of Connecticut are way up by like tenfold, it's still only a few dozen cases that we've identified in the state of Connecticut right now. Nationally, it's a much bigger problem. We've gone from having just a few thousand cases nationally last year to having already 18,500 this year. And I'm going to estimate that we'll hit about 25,000 by the time we finish the year. That's up by at least fourfold from last year's number, and basically like tenfold from 2021 and 2022. So that's another reason why it's hard to diagnose, because people aren't looking for it that often.
Right. And thank you, by the way, for updating the situation here in Connecticut. I'm glad to hear that it might not be quite as profound as some other parts of the country. So you mentioned that some of the young wind up hospitalized. Is that because of the severity of the cough or the potential other problems it could lead to? Or is it that sometimes you cough so hard you hurt yourself?
Yeah, so the hurting probably occurs more in older people, where you can actually break ribs, break vertebrae. You can develop a pneumothorax where the lung actually collapses. But in kids, it's really that they can't get enough air, and their young bodies don't have the capacity to accommodate to a severe infection. They develop an actual pneumonia, a real pertussis pneumonia associated with the cough. And that can make them very much at risk of more severe illness. So in children, you know, they're much more vulnerable. The other reason why they're much more vulnerable is their immune system is far less developed. Most older individuals in this country have probably either been fully vaccinated and or had pertussis during their life. Adults probably get pertussis much more often than we document, but the illness is so mild in people who've been previously vaccinated or infected that we don't notice it nearly as much. And so they end up becoming the reservoir by which children are being infected.
Right. If a child's been vaccinated, does a parent not have to worry about the child getting whooping cough?
Certainly much, much less. But the vaccination schedule is, I believe, five separate vaccinations between the age of I think, 2 months and 6 years. So it's not a single shot. It has what we call waning immunity. It gets less effective over time. And so we augment it, we boost it. And even once you get past the age of six, the recommendation is generally like every 10 years until you're a full adult, and then during pregnancy. And pregnant women in particular, who are generally under-vaccinated for pertussis, are the most important group to get vaccinated because they're the only way to deliver immunity to an infant under 2 months of age. The most vulnerable infants under the age of 2 months can only get immunity through the pregnant mother who gets vaccinated during pregnancy. Hmm. And we're only seeing like half of all pregnant women getting vaccinated against pertussis. So we especially want pregnant women to understand why vaccination is so important.
And it's got to be a challenge, Dr. Foreman, because right nowadays all you hear about is, you know, remember to get your COVID shot, get your flu shot, get your RSV shot. And I guess there's a little bit of, I don't know, vaccine fatigue or just people being a little bit overwhelmed. But what you say is it sounds like it's crucial for pregnant women to get this particular vaccine.
It really is, particularly now that we're seeing so many cases again in the communities across the country. There are states where the numbers are 10 times as high as we're seeing here. So just very important for people to understand why doctors have these vaccination schedules specifically for children, infants, and pregnant women.
And if your child is coughing and you think it's a little bit different than a run-of-the-mill cough that you might get with a cold, what would you say would be a few telltale signs that would lead you to go to the doctor and have your child checked for whooping cough?
I mean, look, if your child is uncomfortable, coughing, seemingly gasping for breath, if your child has a fever for more than a day and seemingly progressive symptoms, always best to seek out medical advice and maybe get swabbed.
And we are talking about all things medical today with Dr. Howie Foreman up at Yale. And another one of the headlines, we were just talking about whooping cough, and this is scary. We've heard about bird flu from time and again recently. The most recent headline I read, Doctor, was that the CDC was sending a team to Washington State to look at the health of some farm workers. They believe that four might have been infected with bird flu. Okay, let's go to the start, I guess. And what is bird flu?
Right. So it's a specific variant of flu that to date has not shown human-to-human transmission. So we've never faced it as a population. It started off only being carried in birds. Obviously, that's why we've continued to call it bird flu. The official title is highly pathogenic avian influenza, avian for birds, and it's called H5N1 to indicate the specific proteins that are involved. Starting in 2022, I think we saw our first case in a human in the United States, and starting this year, we've had multiple outbreaks on chicken farms and dairy farms, and a large number of outbreaks of each. So we've now gotten, I think, 48 of 50 states have had avian infections, birds that they found, either wild birds or chickens. And then we've seen this now in 13 states total, I think, for herds of cows infected, cattle that are infected. And those continue to present periodically. The last cases have been primarily in California and two herds affected in Idaho. What is causing people stress is the fact that we're seeing cases in human beings now. And so for the first time, we're seeing multiple cases in human beings. And other than one case that is partly confirmed, every case has been in a farm worker, somebody who's either been involved in handling the chickens or someone who's been involved in a dairy farm, primarily milking the cattle. So we believe it's primary contact with highly infected animals, and those infections have mostly been mild, and there's been no evidence thus far that it's spreading between humans. If it were to start spreading between humans, we would have a much more serious concern than we do currently.
Right. And again, you know, I think we're all a little bit shell-shocked from the pandemic. Anytime you hear of some somewhat exotic disease, you start to worry, oh, my goodness, could it spread further? How does a person, how exactly do you get bird flu from poultry or from a wild bird?
Yep. So many of the cases appear to be getting in through sort of our mucous membranes, particularly of the eye. I mean, I don't make this to sound as a joke, but it's basically being squirted in the eye by highly infected milk on the dairy farms. That seems to be one of the most common ways to get it. But it's also if you're in a poorly ventilated area and you're involved in handling dead birds for the most part and moving them around, you can imagine that you could be inhaling or otherwise having too much contact with an infected bird. And that's how it seems to be happening. And the good news for these individuals is they've all, to the best of my knowledge, all had self-limited disease. It was not catastrophic. Very few of them have had any time in a hospital. And they seem to have all good outcomes, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't worry about them. The people who are affected, as you can imagine, are typically younger individuals right now. We would not want to see this happening or testing it out in older people.
Right. Treatable, though, doctor, if it were to come to Connecticut and a farm worker were to get it?
Yeah, it's managed in the same way the flu is managed, expectantly. For the most part, we have conservative management. People generally do well. We do have vaccines that we could use for this purpose. So we do have the beginning of a strategy if this were to start spreading among humans. But that is not been used in the United States in a big way yet. And I forget, one of the Nordic countries, I think, was using it for their outbreak among their farm workers.
Doctor, do you feel confident that if it were to get any bigger, any worse, that we would be equipped, as a country to implement a plan to get people vaxxed?
I'm not 100% confident right now because it's hard to know how severe this illness is. Mm-hmm. It's possible, for instance, that the illness will be considerably milder than COVID was or considerably milder than our worst swine flu outbreaks have been. But I would be concerned as it evolves, one could imagine that it could be as severe as COVID or even worse. The original highly pathogenic avian influenza cases from a couple of decades ago in Asia were very lethal with, like, I think 20% or higher fatality rates. We don't want to test that case. We are, as a nation, developing a strategy to deal with this if we did start to see human-to-human outbreak. My biggest concern, my biggest recommendation to every state is to really be testing for it more widely in order to make sure we pick it up as early as possible. We don't want this to be spreading in a large way before we actually know about
it. Right. So, doctor, I had a whole list of topics for us today, including Medicare Advantage, but now I'm up against the clock. We just have a few more minutes. I'd really like to save that segment, if you would. Yeah, because there's so much about it. So many questions and things to explain. Yeah. So,
We're just at the beginning of Medicare Advantage and open enrollment season. So I'd love to talk more with you and your call-in guests if they want to about it in a future segment.
Yeah, you and I will email after the show and set something up for that because I just walking around my neighborhood, I ran into a neighbor who said, "Oh my God, my head is spinning. I'm so confused by all this." But before we go, I do have two more minutes with you, and you did an interesting TikTok on trachoma, a cause of blindness, right? Now, why did you pick that particular topic to talk about and go on social media about?
Because a lot of what I talk about can be depressing at times, and trachoma is a good news story
in the sense that. We like that.
This is, Yeah, this is another curable disease that has been causing blindness throughout the world, particularly in Africa, but also in India, with in a lot of poorer parts of the world. There are over 2 million people that are either fully or partially blind due to this disease, despite the fact that it's completely preventable. And the World Health Organization, supported by the Carter Center, that's Jimmy Carter Center, have made really active efforts to eradicate this completely by 2030. And the good news is that in India, they have completely eradicated it as a public health problem. And that's just such great news, a preventable form of blindness. And we're actually stopping it even in poorer parts of the world.
Oh, that's great. You know, we love a great news story, a happy news story every now and again. And, Doctor, always an absolute pleasure to have you here on the show. Dr. Howie Foreman of the Yale School of Medicine. Until next time when we tackle Medicare Advantage.
You got it.
All righty. Well, there is certainly a lot going on in the world of education here in Connecticut. You might have caught this recent headline. You might have heard it during one of Chris's news updates. UConn looking to cut more than 70 majors. And joining us live on Newsline is the Hartford Current reporter who's been all over this, Allison Cross. Allison, I'm so happy to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, so let's talk about this a little bit. Why are they thinking about cutting majors at UConn? What's going on?
So essentially, a few months ago, earlier in the year, the university administration, the provost's office, started doing a review of low enrollment majors. And essentially, any major was identified for review if within the last 5 years, less than 100 students have graduated with a major in that program. So far, the university has said that they're not making decisions about these programs and that being identified doesn't necessarily mean that your major will be cut. But a May 14th memo from the provost office said that it is anticipated that some programs will close as a result of the review. And the latest deadline right now is that deans and department heads have until November 1st to decide if they want to take their chances and move their programs through review, if they want to recommend that they cut the program, or if they recommend consolidation and combining different majors to try to boost their numbers.
Interesting. Wow. So, Allison, I'm glad we got you on the show today. That November 1st decision deadline is certainly almost upon us. Could you give us a sampling of some of the majors that, I mean, obviously we can't go through the list of 770 right here. That's a lot. But could you give us a sample of some of the majors that might be in the cutting crosshairs?
Yeah, some of the majors that were identified in the review were special education, philosophy, athletic training, environmental studies, social work, a lot of programs within the arts like music and acting, also within the humanities, women's and gender studies, Africana studies, and also a lot of world languages, essentially. All of the university's languages were identified for review with the exception of Spanish.
Wow. I mean, some of the majors that you just listed, they are not obscure. I mean, philosophy, right? Tell us a little bit, if you would, about what the reaction has been. First of all, I'm sure everybody's talking about this at UConn, but have you gotten any feedback from any of the students there?
Yes, students are very concerned. They kind of, a lot of them learned about this through the news. It was actually yesterday that the university kind of sent out an official message to students. But students are very concerned. Even if their programs aren't cut, they're worried about cuts to department budgets and reducing resources and things that might impact their education and experience at UConn moving forward.
Right. So let's just say again, using the example of philosophy, let's say I'm a philosophy major, right? And then I find out that UConn, that they go ahead, we don't know yet, but that they go ahead and say that's not going to be a major anymore. Allison, do we know what a student might do could that major be part of a different major? Or, you know, I guess a lot of students are worried about, gee whiz, you know, I have all these credits toward a major. What happens? Can you tell us more about some of their concerns?
Yeah, the university actually addressed a lot of those concerns in their letter to students yesterday. They said that if at any time that a program closes or is modified, the university creates detailed plans to allow students to complete their degrees. So it'll sort of be a phase out of students who are in that major currently will be able to finish their program, but then new students can't join in. So that's what the university has said so far.
Okay. I mean, does it boil down to a matter of dollars and cents? I guess what I mean is if you say fewer than 100 kids are enrolled in a major, it's not worth the university spending the money on having that major? Is that roughly how it works here?
Well, that is actually kind of one of the criticisms when I've talked to faculty and union leaders. There's a lot of frustration that the only metric for review was the number of students who have completed majors. It didn't take into account how many students might be enrolled in classes because, for example, I minored in women and gender studies when I was at UConn, and those classes, every single class I was in was full and you had trouble getting into some of them. But obviously that was identified for review because not many students are majoring it, even if students are taking electives. But a lot of faculty also said that a lot of these small departments are they don't have many faculty. There's not many students graduating with the major, but they might only be employing 2, 3, sometimes 1 faculty member to keep the major going. So, and right now the university isn't talking about cutting staff or laying off faculty. So a lot of folks were saying that they don't really know how much reducing these programs will actually save the university in the long run. Obviously the university right now, last legislative session, there's a lot of talk about the university's budget and the deficits that they were facing. Right now, when I talked to university officials, they said UConn's still kind of looking at trying to reduce spending by $17.6 million to close the gap for fiscal year 2025. But they said that they're already looking at a funding gap of $72.8 million in fiscal year 2026. So they've asked all their units across the university, including academic, athletics, administration, to reduce their budgets by 3%.
Wow, that's really interesting. Okay, so if they're talking about deficits and they're in the hole financially, Allison, has there been any talk about upping tuition?
I know that tuition has pretty much increased every single year. And when I was speaking to professors, they were also kind of saying that they think that increases in tuition is also kind of fueling what the administration is seeing as kind of a shift away from the humanities. I was speaking to one Italian professor who his major is one of the ones on the chopping block right now. And he said that there's students who are very talented, but they end up going into more lucrative professions because the job opportunities at the end and just how much more expensive university is today, it's just not practical as much. So, yeah, tuition is definitely a concern as well.
Wow. That's so interesting, Allison. And I'm sure we're on with Hartford Current reporter Allison Cross, who's just been publishing some great articles on education in Connecticut, including articles focusing on UConn. And that's so interesting because, yeah, there does seem to be a focus these days, if you will. And here's a vast generalization, but on the STEM majors. I know I have a son in college and he was looking to get an internship and in a more obscure major, right? And, you know, he had a little bit of a time figuring it out, whereas, you know, the perhaps stronger, more robust majors where people feel that they're going to make a good living as soon as they graduate, they don't have much trouble at all finding an internship. It's just kind of interesting the way that it seems that in general we have shifted away a little bit from the studies of the humanities. Did you find that it was that way when you were there, or is that a more recent phenomenon?
I mean, I graduated UConn in 22, so I'm
pretty recent.
I'm in that recent group of folks.
Right.
But I know, speaking with faculty, there was kind of this perception of folks feeling that the administration is putting more of an emphasis on STEM and kind of is taking away, trying to kind of steer away from the humanities. And it was kind of a narrative that even the university president addressed in a letter that went out to staff last week. She said that nothing could be further than the truth, that we want to have vibrant humanities at UConn. But she did say that some students kind of are turning away from these fields, and that as a university, they need to make sure that they are keeping up with the times and with need.
Yeah, I understand you need to be practical, and everybody wants to get a good job after graduation. But there's also something to be said for learning things for the sake of learning and really becoming a well-educated, well-rounded person when you're in college. Let's go back to all things UConn, and joining us back on Newsline is Allison Cross, a reporter for the Hartford Courant. And Allison, I mentioned during the break, we've been talking about the potential of cuts to majors at UConn, but also they are looking to implement an institutional neutrality policy. Now, that sounds so dry, but this is really important. Can you explain it to us and tell us what it has to do with any protests on campus?
Yeah, so to preface, the university kind of hasn't put forth an official proposal or language, but institutional neutrality is something that kind of has been around since the 1960s. So it's expected that kind of whatever UConn adopts will kind of fall in the form that many universities have followed. And essentially what it says is that the university won't make comments on social issues or events that are outside of kind of the scope of UConn. It doesn't impact what students or professors could say.
Professors. Okay, gotcha.
Yes, it's essentially kind of in the past, the university has made statements on, as when I say the university, things like administrators, the president, they've commented, for example, when George Floyd died, also the fall of Roe versus Wade, the war in Ukraine, protests in various parts of the world. And essentially what this would say is kind of, we're not going to make comments unless it has to do with UConn directly.
I'm guessing because if you do make a comment, it can get you into all kinds of trouble.
Exactly. It's kind of, if you say something about one thing, but then you're silent on another, then you can get accusations of bias. So a lot of universities, especially with the protests over the Israel-Hamas war, have really been adopting institutional neutrality policies, especially over the summer. Schools like Harvard, Northwestern, Stanford, over a dozen have adopted these policies within the last few months.
Right. Important to be impartial or neutral, because if you're the folks devising any sort of policies on campus, you don't want to seem like you have a bias in one way or the other.
Yes.
Right. So tell us, while we're on the topic, what has it been like? You've done a lot of reporting, obviously, on UConn. Have there been a lot of protests this fall in particular, as things have really, there have been so many developments lately from the Middle East and the fighting, you know, on two fronts over there. What have you been hearing, if anything, about that, the protests?
Yeah, there's been a number of protests this semester. Obviously, last semester, a total of 26 demonstrators were arrested on campus when pro-Palestinian activists kind of started an encampment protest there. And that was kind of how things ended last school year. But this school year, there's been a number of protests, and the university has also kind of gotten some criticism for changing a lot of its policies around what is and is not allowed with things like amplified sound, using bullhorns and speakers and that sort of thing if you're kind of trying to stage a protest on campus. So there's been a number of protests this semester.
All righty. I appreciate the update and appreciate you and for staying with us through the course of this half hour here on Newsline, the Hartford Currents, Allison Cross. And Allison, give us a ring, send us an email, let us know what you're working on. It seems like you're always working on some really interesting story involving education. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
All right. We shall talk again soon.